WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we begin a week-long series that takes the long view beyond the war on terror. How do we hope the world will look 10 years from now? What big goals should guide the war effort? This hour, we're taking the long view of the role of the United States in the world with Harvard's Stanley Hoffman. First, listening for the voices of moderate Muslims. As the bombing campaign in Afghanistan continues, Muslims appear to have closed ranks. It's become harder for those who disagree with militant groups to speak out. Earlier today, I spoke to Peter Ford, senior European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, about this so-called silent Islamic majority.
Well, the moderate voices in Islam are quiet at the moment and are not very numerous anyway. And with the bombing in Afghanistan, the more moderate leaders of Islam, who are opposed to bin Laden and the extremists, are having a hard time because they are caught between a rock and a hard place. They are as horrified by what happened in New York as they are horrified by what's happening in Afghanistan now. They do not want to have to choose, as Mr. Bush and Mr. bin Laden asked them to choose, to be on one side or the other. They're against both.
But is this really a silent majority? Can we presume that a majority of people in the Islamic world are in fact moderate, or has that changed? Is it now a silent minority?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when you go to Muslim countries, whether it be in the Middle East or elsewhere, the vast majority of people just want to get on with their lives the same way as you or I do. And it's not a question of religion, it's just a question of living your life. They feel close to other Muslims, which means that they feel sympathetic to Afghans and the civilians there who are inevitably dying under the American bombs. As one person put it to me in Cairo, most Arabs, at any rate in the Middle East, have stopped thinking about 9/11, and now they're thinking about 10/7. That was the day that the bombing raids began.
But surely moderate folks in the Islamic world can see the dangers of the kind of polarization that emerges if all of Islam rallies only around Afghanistan and the West rallies only around New York. Don't they have or feel some responsibility to stand up from their side and answer moderate voices from the rest of the world?
Some of them do, and there are such voices. But the trouble is, at the moment, in the current, as you say, the current polarized atmosphere, anybody who stands up and speaks radically against the radicals is seen as an objective ally of the United States. Frankly, I don't think they'll be heard if they stand up against the radicals at the moment. That's the problem for them.
Is that what they're doing? Friday prayers are a way to take the global pulse of Islam. Measure for us the religious fervor and tension there. Give us that reading from the pulpit.
Well, it depends which mosques you attend, in fact. Here in the Grand Mosque in Paris, the imams from the pulpit are giving very measured and rather more spiritually oriented khutbas or sermons. Out in the suburbs, which are heavily populated by Algerians, Moroccans, and other North Africans, there are more informal mosques, more informal imams who are giving very much fierier speeches, much more along the lines of what Mr. bin Laden would say. In London, it's very much the same. There are one or two radical mosques where you'll hear very radical messages. Most of the mosques are run by official imams who, as I say, don't have much to say about politics at the moment. And that perhaps is part of the problem, because the ones who are addressing the political issues, the here and now issues, tend to be the radicals, not the moderates.
Osama bin Laden calls for a jihad or holy war against the United States. Just yesterday, an imam in New York called for jihad against Osama bin Laden. Is that finding an echo among other moderates? And if so, why aren't they saying so?
I think it's finding more of an echo in the United States and in Europe, where the moderate voices are more numerous and bolder and find probably a more ready audience than in the Middle East or Pakistan. Imams like the imam of the Brooklyn Mosque, who says that, are surer that they are amongst friendly ears when they say that sort of thing. I think in the Middle East, where there is much more resentment of U.S. foreign policy traditionally, that's a harder message to get across and a more daring message to voice.
So when Washington reaches out with its message that this is not a crusade, that this is not aimed against Islam, is there any group out there that has its ears and mind open to that message and might even pick it up and discuss it with fellow Muslims.
It's a hard message to get across. I think the fact that the United States and the United Kingdom are stepping up their public relations efforts with new offices in Pakistan and elsewhere is an indication of the fact that the United States knows that his message is not getting across. And it's not an impossible message to give, but it's a hard one, and I think the United States are going to have to do a lot more. I think it would help if this war against terrorism was more clearly directed against other terrorists than just Islamic ones. But that clearly we're going to have to wait for a second phase in the war for that to happen, if it happens at all.
Peter, you can see in Europe and certainly in the United States there's a range of response to everything that's going on. Why do you think there's less robust range of response in the Islamic world?
For one thing, historically, over the last 10 or 15 years, the extremists, the radicals, often armed, have not only been extremely well-financed, mainly from Saudi Arabia, while more moderate voices are disunited and poor, those moderate voices have also been terrified and bludgeoned into silence in many countries. I mean, in countries like Algeria and Egypt, the armed extremists have not just been fighting government troops or killing foreigners, they've also been killing intellectual opponents within the Muslim community. And it has been literally a matter of life and death to express yourself or not in those countries. Under those circumstances, even relatively brave moderates sometimes decide that it would be discretion is the better part of valor.
Peter Ford is senior European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke to him earlier from Paris. A decade from now, how should the United States aim to be positioned in the world? Will America still play the global cop? Base its foreign policy on promoting world trade? Will it stand for democracy, hope, justice? We're looking ahead this hour, beyond the war in Afghanistan and the fight against terrorism, what should be at the heart of America's role in the world 10 years from now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us tonight is Stanley Hoffman. He's a big thinker on international relations at Harvard University and author of many books on the subject, including World Disorders, Troubled Peace in the Post-Cold War Era. Welcome, Stanley Hoffman.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Stanley Hoffman.
Hello.
Stanley Hoffman and Jack, we're biting off something big tonight. It's a little outsized, and we know it, but we're acting on the maxim that we should start with the end in mind. And we're starting into a new war here. Stanley Hoffman, you're a great tall tree in the forest of foreign policy analysts. We're trying to look ahead to see how, if we can imagine a vision of where the U.S. ought to be in its global role 10 years from now that might inform the way policy is being made right now that will help all of us think about the best way ahead. So let me start with just a big, broad question.
Yes.
Where should the U.S. be in a decade in its relationship with the world? A return to status quo pre-September 11th or something different?
Well, I very much hope it would be something different. I think the United States has assumed much too easily and lazily that since it is so infinitely more powerful than almost, well, really, than any state that theoretically might challenge it, it didn't really have to be terribly imaginative since things had worked out so well. In a sense, we've taken the present condition of pre-September 11 for granted, and we're willing not just to make merely minor adjustments, but we've been even talking about retreating further in the belief that we could, by getting less engaged in minor disputes, continue nevertheless to be the great balancer in the world, the maintainer of peace, the agent of free trade, and so on. And it seems to me that among the many lessons of September 11, the first one is that, yes, we may be more powerful than any potential state challenger, Russia, China, a rather still inchoate and unorganized European Union. But we can be very badly wounded by terrorists who are individuals for whom globalization is both a disgrace, for many of them at least, but also a tremendous help because it allows them to move themselves and their money across borders, and they don't even need nuclear weapons, or they don't even need anthrax to cause an enormous amount of damage. And I think we had a little bit forgotten about all the forces in international politics which are not traditional, like terrorists or drug traffickers and so on and so forth. So we have to wake up to that threat. And it seems to me that there are only two ways of dealing with them. One is, of course, to try to catch them, which is a very slow, very difficult process, which will require an enormous amount of cooperation of polices and so on all over the world. So my first lesson is that we cannot go about international affairs just by ourselves. We desperately need others to both prevent and arrest terrorists. And the second thing we need to do, which it seems to me is rather evident, is to act in such a way that public opinion in the different countries of the world does not turn against the United States, or does not say a plague on all your houses if something like September 11 happens again.
So if we want to, if indeed we want to work with others, if we acknowledge that we need that after September 11th, and we want to be well regarded in world public opinion, what changes does that suggest in U.S. posture toward the world?
Well, I think one has to distinguish between short and long term here. I think in the short term, given bin Laden, given the need to reassure American opinion, which, if it sees no results quickly, is likely to turn more militaristic and listen to those who would like to enlarge the war under the pretext that we could perhaps get rid of all the terrorists in the world in one fell swoop. I think in the short run, I think we have to create a coalition, even with sometimes very unsavory allies. We don't have much choice here. But I think that in the long run, if we do want, since we need multilateral action, we should push much more, precisely because we have so many means to do so, to get some of these governments who are currently our allies and who are in part responsible for the terrorism that has struck us, to reform, to open up, to listen a little bit more to their own people, to reduce inequalities in their countries, and to democratize. I think if we do not do this, if we continue to treat human rights as, in a sense, the last wheel of the car of foreign policy, and one which is really usually found in the trunk but not running it, we are going to be in very serious trouble.
Jack Beatty, we're talking with Stanley Hoffman, taking the long view of where we want the U.S. to be in a decade. It's a long time up, but we're hoping it informs our policy right now. Do you feel the government taking the long view in the way it's proceeding?
No, not at all.
How about you, Jack?
No, I don't. I don't. I'm heartened that Colin Powell seems to be at least open to that kind of thinking, and he's at least talking to people from other countries. But I'm terribly worried about the insular Bush and you know, George Bush has been abroad, I think, twice in his lifetime. And not for lack of cash. I'm worried that insularity is not going to leave him open to this larger view, because we're finding out again and again how human rights, rather than being something that undermines our stability, is in fact the pathway to greater stability. Democracies don't fall apart. Democracies contain their terrorists.
Jack and Stanley Hoffman, we're going to have to take a quick break here. All this week, we're taking the long view, looking way out. Tonight, we're looking at the U.S. role in the world 10 years out with Stanley Hoffman, political scientist at Harvard University, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. How do you want the U.S. to be positioned in the world in 10 years? What role, what impact, what priorities do you want the United States to have on the other side of this war on terrorism? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight we're taking the long view of the U.S. role in the world, looking past the war on terrorism, maybe 10 years out, to help inform our view of how we prosecute the war on terrorism today. What are we shooting for on the other side? What kind of country do we want to be? What do you want to see when you look in the mirror 10 years from now? What should we stick with? What should we change for our own good and for the world? We're joined tonight by Stanley Hoffman. He's a political scientist at Harvard University, and our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Stanley Hoffman, just before the break, we were talking about what we should look for in Washington's policy right now and what signs that they're looking long-term. But what are the big trends that Washington and the country ought to be aware of that are affecting the world, that are changing the world, that we have to be aware of as we're looking out maybe a decade?
Well, it seems to me that one of the trends, which we haven't really looked at very closely in recent years, is the increasing gap between the rich and the poor countries in the world. The United States contributes less in development aid proportionally than practically any other major country. And instead, the choice that seems to be made is that if we ever have a little surplus of money, we either have a tax cut or we give some of that money to the richest in our own country. But we acquire a good conscience about helping other countries narrow that gap between rich and poor nations by saying that foreign aid never really works, that these countries have to lift themselves by their own efforts, which ultimately is true, but you can do that only if you have a certain minimum first, and we haven't done much about this.
Well, let's say we were going to take that advice and do it. Does it mean a change in U.S. lifestyles?
No, I don't think so. I think that it probably means perhaps a slight slowing down of, I'm not talking about a recession period, but assuming that, as before, we have a fairly long periods of economic growth interrupted by occasional recessions. It means perhaps that during the periods of growth, we would consume a little bit less, although if one sees the amount of waste and the way in which this growth is distributed, even in our own country, I'm thinking of the state in which many of the public services or transportation services or health services are left by comparison with other advanced societies. It means not so much a tightening of the belt as a redistribution of the flesh, if you like.
We're taking the long view tonight with Stanley Hoffman of Harvard University of the U.S. role in the world and where it ought to be, maybe 10 years out, on the other side of a war on terrorism. How do you want the U.S. to be positioned in the world? What role, what impact, what priorities do you want the United States to have taking the long view? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, you and Stanley Hoffman were both talking about the new degree of interrelatedness in the world and how we respond to that. Stanley Hoffman is raising greater U.S. foreign aid and concern for global poverty as part of that. But in the last 10 years, I think we pursued just all-out capitalism, and it produced an awful lot of wealth in this country and some spillover. Can we just pursue our national interest and trust the invisible hand to do the rest globally?
I don't think so. I think globalization is identified with the United States, I think wrongly. The United States is subject to it as well as the subject of it. But it is a destabilizing force, and it is a force that has yet to address the gap that that Stanley talks about. And left to its own devices, it will not. It did not in this country. That is to say, when we had our experiment with social Darwinism and, devil take the hindmost capitalism, yes, after the Civil War, it left a kind of social ruin. We were maximizing our economic progress at the cost of our society. It was only with the New Deal, an intervention in the market that set up a floor, that created some security for people, and that gave ordinary people a stake in capitalism. It's the New Deal we need as our model internationally, I think, for the next 10 years. Because unless something makes it so that globalization works for everybody and not just for the elites,
yes,
we're going to have more and more instability in the world.
How about it, Stanley Hoffman? New Deal for the world. You've written that our national interest may now mean seeking partners in a quest for the many. That sounds almost like a synonym for New Deal.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I would simply point out that in Europe, this sort of reform of capitalism started already earlier than in the United States. It really started towards the end of the 19th or the first years of the 20th century. But there are enormous similarities, you know. I think the governments themselves in England or in France realize that if they don't make an effort to get the goods distributed more fairly and increase the chances for the poor and not just the incomes, but really the chances to go ahead and get ahead in society, that the governments themselves would be blown away.
But for the last 10 years, Stanley Hoffman, the United States has been laughing at Europe with its high unemployment and relatively sluggish economies while we roared ahead. Was that laughter misplaced?
I think it was partly misplaced because I think in the statistics about unemployment, a little bit, more than a little bit, depends on how you measure unemployment. It is true that it has been higher, but it has been higher often because of, indeed, excessive regulations and too many obstacles to initiative. But I repeat, the Europeans have given more, perhaps to expiate colonialism, have given more to poor countries proportionally than the United States have, and have been also in their rhetoric much more careful than the United States, which with its eternal promise of trickle-down. And the other thing is that it seems to me that development is only one aspect of what needs to be done. I think if the world could see the United States the way Mr. Bush seems to see it, as a wonderful, great country which always does good for mankind, that's perhaps asking too much. But it certainly would be a progress in comparison with what many people think now, because what they see is the United States over the period of the Cold War and even since supporting pretty hideous regimes in exchange for bases or in exchange for oil or what have you. And that does not make the United States very popular. It seems to me that much of, not all, but since there are so many different forms of terrorism, but that much of the more violent terrorism is aimed at regimes that are, in their eyes, regimes imposed on their people by the United States. Egypt is, along with Israel, the country that receives the greatest amount of aid from the United States.
Stanley Hoffman, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Yep. I'm sure they'll help inform it. Let's turn to them now. We're talking about the long view of U.S. role in the world, looking out maybe a decade past the war on terror to inform our prosecution of that war. We're looking ahead at where we want to end up on the other side. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Tony is on the line. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think in ten years, I would certainly love to see the United States investing in these countries that we're currently fighting with, and I like the way that we did after World War II. We had to take care of business like we do have to now. I think there are certain things that we just have to deal with, but I think after that, I would love to see us having the same sort of relationships we have with Japan and Germany now. That these companies, these countries, realize that that stuff happens, but now we want to see them succeed. And I'd also like to see us have a much more balanced relationship with Israel and the other Muslim countries.
Tony, would you be willing to accept some hit to the pace of U.S. economic growth to make those kinds of investments in these countries?
I don't really understand that. I don't know why. Well, like the amount of money we're spending right now on military and things like that, why couldn't that be the same sort of...
just divert.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Tony, thanks for your call. Stanley Hoffman, here's one American who's ready to put more money into development. He also raises this issue of the U.S. and Israel.
Yes.
What about that? It's been a key feature of U.S. foreign policy, our largest single recipient of foreign aid. How do you see that evolving over the next decade?
Oh, my. It does not look good at present. On the other hand, one has to remember that at the end of January of this year, the two sides, even several months after the fiasco in at Camp David, were extremely close to an agreement. I think the mistake was to try to obtain a global settlement as if it was a sprint. But I think that if one could have had a few more months of secret negotiations, as had been the case at Oslo, one could have gotten an agreement. Remember, the negotiations that went on after Camp David continued even after the beginning of Intifada number 2. Mm. And this is why I hope that perhaps with some prodding from Colin Powell, we could get the parties gradually.
So that's a huge challenge. It's huge.
But looking
further out, Stanley Hoffman, yeah. we hear this cry right now from some quarters, let's see more balance in the relationship between Israel and the Islamic world. Do you see that coming? Do you recommend it?
I don't see it so much in terms of balance. I see it in terms of getting the two parties to agree on a settlement which would leave both, A, with the right to self-determination, and B, with fairly basic security. And I think that at present, Sharon is certainly an obstacle. And I think that the kind of terrorism which still goes on the other side is also an obstacle. But I don't believe that this cannot be overcome. I think there was... and probably still is a great desire after so many years of tension and so many deaths for a settlement. And I think that the efforts of the moderates on both sides to renew some sort of contacts are really what we ought to encourage, because the gap was not so enormous.
And yet, I hear there the possibility of 10 years from now, something still not being resolved. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We're taking the long view of the U.S. role in the world, looking to the other side of the war on terrorism. How do you want the U.S. to be positioned 10 years out? What role, what impact, what priorities do you want the United States to have? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Patricia is on the line. Hi, Patricia.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Very good program. I wonder if you would consider two things. First of all, that we become less interested in sovereignty, that we become more involved with the United Nations, that we work under law, as we do in the United States, supposedly, anyway, and make an attempt in that direction. It may take much longer than 10 years, but if we don't, I think we may blow ourselves up before the end of 10 years.
Patricia, thanks for your call. Let's put it to Stanley Hoffman. Stanley Hoffman, there was a kind of embedded assumption in the 20th century that maybe we were working toward this kind of goal, that the UN would emerge as more and more powerful. By the end of the century, that seemed in something like disarray. Is that the way that globalization is going to unfold, with less sovereignty and more UN stature, or do you see something else?
I don't think that... I don't quite see it happening that way. It seems to me that all of the states until September were losing sovereignty, largely because of globalization. But the beneficiary was not the UN. The beneficiary was, to a very large extent, the world took a rather unregulated market. Mm-hmm. It isn't just states versus UN. Mm-hmm. You have huge areas, particularly in international economy, which are not regulated at all. The ease with which capital can move from one country to the other and thus destabilize currencies, for instance, foreign investments are not as regulated as world trade, for instance. So you can lose sovereignty without in any way reinforcing the UN. And I think one of the problems with reinforcing the UN has been that we've always been extremely ambivalent about the UN. We applaud it when we lead it, and the members of the UN do pretty much what we'd like them to do. But the minute they do something which we don't like, for instance, setting up an international criminal court, you can hear in this country extravagant speeches about how the United Nations is going to take over American sovereignty and about how we don't really need them because we are so powerful.
But can that last, given the realities that we've had forced into our face since September 11th? Can that posture survive? Do you look out a decade, do you think we'll still be hearing the same debate?
You know, I'm an old man, and I've heard this debate for most of my adult life. So the capacity of people to go on being unreasonable in an almost hereditary way is practically unlimited. I think one needs just a massive effort of educating the public in any possible way so as to open their eyes on what happens outside. Most Americans are, I think, people of extraordinary goodwill and generosity. But they are not that interested, except as tourists, in what goes on abroad.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Globalization is said to be weakening the nation state, and Stanley Hoffman seconds the notion. Political fragmentation is weakening it. But over the next decade, how do you think the U.S. will take that on board?
Well, I don't know. I think that we have to get to transnational. I think this was really what Patricia was suggesting, yeah. Transnational institutions precisely to protect our sovereignty and to protect our nation. It isn't the Daniel Bell says the nation state is too big to do the things that it really needs to do, the small things, and it's too small to handle the big problems. and that's we're in a kind of dilemma here for the nation state. And absent transnational institutions that can regulate this market, it will be a very bad – more and more power will flow away from the nation state. And we'll have a situation really where it'll be a kind of elite-to-elite world. I mean, globalization, if it just serves one elite in one country and the other elite in the next country, this isn't going to work. This is a recipe for more instability and probably down the line more terrorism. That was the way much of our foreign policy was after the Second World War. It was our elites making security policy and dealing with their elites. And the values of the American people were kind of left out. I mean, if you had said to people, do you want to intervene in Angola, they would have said, where is it? Mm. And yet we did. And in Afghanistan and in 25 or 30 other places around the world, either directly or through other parties.
But we can hardly pull back, Jack.
Well, I think the idea that we're the indispensable nation has got to undergo some rehabilitation in our own. That's not doing us any good.
We're looking 10 years out at the U.S. role in the world on the other side of the war on terror. What do you want to see 10 years out when you look in the mirror? What should we stick with? What should we change? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can find a timeline of the history of U.S. foreign policy on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. All this week, we're taking the long view of the war on terrorism and beyond. Tonight, we're looking at the U.S. role in the world, looking maybe a decade out and asking, what ought it look like? What should it be? What do you think? How do you want the U.S. to be positioned in the world 10 years on? What role, what impact, what priorities do you want the United States to have? We're joined tonight by Stanley Hoffman, professor of political science at Harvard University, and our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and a lot of people want to join this conversation. Bob is on the line right now. Welcome, Bob.
Hi. Good evening.
Hi.
My question was in relation to the democratization of other countries, our help to them. Isn't it eventually you come back and actually help us economically if you can help stabilize other economies and other nations?
Bob, it's a really tough line, but I think I got just enough fragment from you. Let me pass it on to Stanley Hoffman.
I didn't hear the question.
Yes, I think I can translate.
Okay.
Bob was asking about investing in democratization in other countries. We've talked some about U.S. intervention, and Jack Beatty was suggesting maybe we should pull back from that. On the other hand, can we be seen as standing up for American ideals if we don't somehow invest in democratization? Do we have the stomach for that? Do we have the fire in the belly to support democratization, Stanley Hoffman, with the potential upheaval and uncertainty that that might bring?
Well, 2 points. One is that we cannot obviously do it alone. We cannot export democracy. Mm-hmm. Not so simple. We did it to a large extent in Germany and Japan. But this was after a total victory in a total war. And even in those two cases, there were moderates who were willing to pursue this democratization. So we can't do it alone. But secondly, it seems to me that idealism has become the only form of realism. Just imagine a world in which terrorism has become even more widespread than now, mm-hmm. in which terrorists blow up things all over the place in countries which they accuse of being responsible for the misery of their people. The first thing that will disappear after a while, because people cannot live for a very long time mm-hmm. in anarchy or in chaos, will be a disappearance or a sharp curtailing of democracy at home. And if one does not want them, for instance, even now there are people who discuss the usefulness of torture in order to extract concessions.
It's in the papers.
Confessions. Yeah, exactly. So it seems to me if one does not act in what many would consider to be a totally unusual way, selflessness instead of the usual selfishness of states, protection and development of human rights abroad instead of just the acquisition of bases and resources. If one does not do this, we will end up in an unlivable world.
Jack Beatty, what about it? Stanley Hoffman is suggesting that idealism has become the only form of realism. Are Americans ready for that?
Well, you know, there is a lot of that in our history.
Yes.
I mean, it's only in recent years and really with Henry Kissinger and Mr. Nixon that a kind of brutalist notion of U.S. foreign policy, very discordant with American values, has come to prevail. And under Clinton, it was something else. It was a kind of economic idea that, you know, the world was just a market, that we didn't have another stake in it. Yeah, I think that that Stanley, you can't improve on that form. That our strength in the world comes from our ideals, the value we give to the individual, our Bill of Rights, our notions of freedom. Here's our strength. And in the Cold War, we continually sort of undercut it with our actions. And Stanley is suggesting that now that's got to stop. We've got to act in accord with those values precisely to increase our national security.
How interesting that should sound so novel. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line. Welcome, John.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
My question really is related to our domestic policies as they relate to our abilities to change internationally.
Okay.
And my fear is that we're kind of steeped in 19th and early 20th century thought here, and we haven't learned from the past. And it seems to me that we have a tremendous amount of change in our energy policy, in our attitude toward fuel economy in our cars, on our attitude towards the ecology and environment. And we need to make those changes here that may have tremendous economic ramifications in the short term, in order to advance on the international front. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on those issues.
Thanks very much for the question, John. Stay tuned. Tomorrow night we're talking about energy policy. But Stanley Hoffman, John encourages to look entirely past geopolitics at kind of the fundamentals, domestic policy, ecological policy, energy policy. How do you see those factoring in?
Oh, I think he's entirely right. And that's, again, a case in which reversing course will become a matter of national security, including when it comes to pollution, when it comes to climate change, fuel and so on. If we continue in essentially not worrying about it and saying, well, the American consumer or the American companies rather would never accept this, we would end up with disasters. So it is part of the same effort. It came to my mind that the French, who have had, as I well know since I came from there, an extremely French-centered system of education, particularly for their elites, have now completely reversed course, and that the students who go to the elite schools, which provide the civil service with its leaders and then the government also, these students are now obliged to spend some time studying abroad to find out how the others live. And it seems to me that in addition to everything that we have already mentioned, it would not be a bad idea at all to do something similar in American...
With the U.S.
Yes, exactly, because the ignorance is massive.
Stanley Hoffman, we've just got another minute, so I don't have much time, but we took a lot of pride in the 90s that we ended up as the sole superpower.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a valuable position, or will we still be the sole superpower 10 years on?
You know, ultimately, it's not a terribly enviable position. Nobody likes a superpower, really. And when there are no other powers to take some of the burden away from the superpower, all it can say all the time is, aren't we great? Aren't we indispensable? But ultimately, the costs to the country are enormous. It has to do things it would prefer not to do, and nobody is particularly full of pity for the poor superpower. So I don't think it's that desirable.
Stanley Hoffman, thank you very much for joining us this evening. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Stanley Hoffman is professor of political science at Harvard University, the author of, most recently, World Disorders, Troubled Peace in the Post-Cold War Era. Jack Beatty, always great to hear from Stanley Hoffman. You know, he's a soft-spoken guy, but he's laying out a pretty big agenda. Idealism emerging as the only form of realism is pretty big to begin with, and the idea that we can't protect our own affluence longer term if others don't at least have a hope of sharing in life, liberty, and happiness.
Yes, in a way, he's saying that we're part of the human family, and that the accidental placement of people in nations long has blinded us to that fact. But we are part of the same species, and that, it seems to me, is one of the things this century can start to work out, a true global consciousness to catch up with the globalizing economy, such that our concern for human rights in other countries will become really as concerned about that as we are for inequalities and abuses of rights in our own country.
But what's the path, Jack, from the patriotism and kind of nationalism we're feeling right now to this new global view?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I mean, I think that you know, if people reflect on the nature of American patriotism, they'll see that we're really loyal basically to documents and to utterances and to projections of value. We're not about blood and soil and kind of European mystical nationalism. We're about universalistic ideals. That is what America is in the world, and has been from the beginning. And I think that's a basis for a kind of American patriotism that can say, just as Stanley Hoffman was saying, that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness should be for everybody.
Jack Beatty, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking all this week about the long view. Tomorrow night, we're looking at energy policy. You can join the conversation, tonight's conversation, online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, beer and a bull session. The patrons of the Brass Rail Tavern in Troutdale, Oregon, are still bewildered about why the U.S. was attacked on September 11th. But they do have opinions on how we should proceed from here.
My name's Ted Rippey. I'm a traveling salesman. Frozen bull semen to dairy farmers. And if you want to hurt us, come right out front and just hurt us. You know, take us on. Don't do it behind our backs. That's not right. So pretty much whatever they get, they get. I mean, I know we're big and strong and everything, but don't stab us in the back. And I don't want to kill innocent people, but yet, you know, what are you going to do? You can't just do nothing. So I mean, I think it's almost like something you do that you don't want to do, like taking a test or, you know, reprimanding a child or something like that. I mean, you know you don't want to do it. It's not fun. But, I mean, you have to. You can't just do nothing. I don't know. I mean, in my mind, it's really complicated. I mean, they associate us with Israel, so, I mean, that whole thing's just messed up. But, I don't know. I think they're just using religion as an excuse, you know, because I don't really believe any religion would condone that kind of a thing. So, I mean, I think we're a pretty open-minded country. I mean, but I don't, sometimes, I mean, I guess they really hate us, and I don't really know why.
My name is Tom W. Armstrong, and I live in Gresham, Oregon, and a former school teacher. High school teacher of U.S. history. This is a tragedy of great proportion, and it's really amazing that the United States will be attacked like this when we accept so many people in our ranks to take share in our education, and that this should happen to the United States. It's amazing. I'm sure that our borders are going to tighten, but we do accept people from all over the world, because that's what made America great. Our government's handled this, I think, great. I think the way President Bush handled the situation and talked about it and acted upon it has been exemplary.
My name is Rick, locomotive engineer. I don't think they're doing enough. Bring it on. They want a war. We'll give them a war. Nuke them. Well, they're just worthless people. Bin Laden, for one, but anybody that has anything to do with him, anybody over there. I mean, it's all just barren, poverty-stricken land, period, anyway. I do know there's a lot of people over there that had nothing to do with it, but they're still brainwashed. Well, we're moving in the right direction, but I'd nuke them. That'll get all the caves.
My name is Joan Davis, and I work in the deli at a truck stop. I thought maybe they should have reacted a little faster. But I just think they should have rushed along with more than what, sooner than what they did. And I'm not really sure, you know, they send those rations over there all the time. I was watching that on TV the other night, and I'm not really sure that that they're sending enough to feed all the people that really need them. And I think that, you know, if they're going to send some, that they should send enough for everybody and have enough supply so that nobody starves to death. I can't understand, you know, they came over here and they've gone to school. They've interacted with other people that live here, and I would have thought that, you know, they would have had to got away from that environment over there and had some self-esteem for their own life, and they've made friends and thought something of them, of their friends and stuff, but instead they just kind of just blanked everything out and just, and I just don't understand what Bin Laden did to make these people want to die for him.
Those were the voices of patrons at the Brass Rail Tavern in Troutdale, Oregon. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.